Chapter 4, The Abode of Peace. The overnight journey from Siliguri to Manihat Ghat was not an enjoyable experience, especially if one's compartment happened to be crowded, as ours certainly was. But there was at least one compensation: the sight of the sun rising above the river as one crossed by paddle steamer from the northern to the southern bank of the Ganges to catch the connecting train a few miles downstream. Sanchin, Bill and I had left Siliguri the previous evening after making arrangements for the dispatch of the boxes containing Bill's spirit traps. Dinesh saw us off. I felt a little uneasy at leaving him at the Hermitage with no companion save Man Bahadur, who in any case could not be relied on to spend much time at his place of work, since my young, ex-untouchable friend sometimes became depressed when he thought of the plight of his family in the plains, and since, moreover, his Nepalese contemporaries did not always show him much consideration, one of them, in fact, having struck him a blow that reduced him to tears. I therefore assured him that I would write to him regularly and asked him to write to me. The inter-class compartment into which my two companions and I had managed to insert ourselves being so crowded, there was no question of our lying down for the night, at least not on the hard wooden seating, and Sanchin and I therefore sat up throughout the journey, while Bill, either more resourceful or less concerned about appearances, climbed up onto the luggage rack and stretched out there. Though I had had not more than 2 hours' sleep, I felt not at all tired the following morning when, on our arrival at Manihari Ghat, we descended from the train and ploughed our way in the semi-darkness through half a mile of soft, loose sand to the ferry, our red-shirted coolies preceding us with our luggage. As we embarked, the sun lifted his burning brow above the horizon, and within minutes, as it seemed, there was a silver disk shining through the mist and lighting up the vast expanse of the river with a dull, leaden gleam. Half an hour later, when we were in midstream and out of sight of land, the silver disk, breaking free of the mist and the banks of low cloud, turned to a disk of burnished gold that glittered down at us from above the twin funnels of the ferry out of a sky immaculately blue. So brightly did it eventually glitter that it was no longer possible to look at it, and I turned away to gaze out over the waters of the Ganges, now jewel-bespangled, and to listen to the sound of the giant paddle wheels churning their way through the turbid water. With 400 or 500 other souls, I was suspended between two mighty elements, those of water and air, a third element, fire, being represented by the sun that shone so fiercely upon us. Hardly had we reached the Sakalugalu Ghat after spending 2 hours on the ferry than our ears were assaulted by a continuous hollow drumming sound, so loud that it almost drowned the cries of passengers disembarking. The sound came from beneath our feet. It came from the lower deck of the ferry, came from the madly pounding feet of the hundreds of red-shirted figures who, as soon as the vessel came alongside, stampeded on board, swarmed up the stairways, and rushed to stake a claim to the luggage of the first, second, and inter-class passengers. Third-class passengers generally carried their own luggage, it being understood that the first coolie to lay hands on one's bundles and boxes had the right to be engaged to carry them. I did not always respect this convention, usually preferring to ignore the younger, more active coolies in favour of their older colleagues, who, though slower, were more reliable, and on this occasion too probably followed my rule. Be that as it may, we were soon off the ferry and into the train, which proved to be less crowded than the one in which we had spent the first part of our journey, so that we were able to watch the unfolding panorama of the Bengal countryside with its lotus ponds, mud huts, and groves of coconut palms from a position of comparative comfort. On our arrival at Bolpur, we took a broken-down old taxi to Shantiniketan, where Sanchin and I were soon installed in the guest house. Shantiniketan meant the abode of peace, and situated as it was in the heart of rural West Bengal, the place certainly deserved the name. I'd first heard that name in 1945, when still in the army and stationed in Calcutta. I'd been in the habit of spending as much of my off-duty time as I could at the Ramakrishna Mission Institute of Culture, where it's possible to meet some of the most distinguished members of the city's Bengali intelligentsia. When, having heard the name of the place two or three times, I inquired of my friend Kantaraj, the diminutive Ramakrishna Order Swami, who worked at the institute, what sort of place Shantiniketan was, he mischievously replied that it was an educational institution where they turned boys into girls and girls into boys, meaning by this that the school's artistic atmosphere had the effect of rendering the male students effeminate and the female ones mannish. During the next few years, I continued to hear the name of Shantiniketan, the abode of peace, usually in connection with the fine arts, or in a way that suggested that it was a kind of Bengali counterpart to the British arts and crafts movement. Since my arrival in Kalimpong, I'd heard it more often than ever, mainly due to the presence in the town during the summer months of Pratima Devi, the niece and daughter-in-law of Rabindranath Tagore, the founder of Shantiniketan, who, since the latter's death in 1941, had been mainly responsible for keeping alive the flame of his vision for the place, and with whom I became quite well acquainted, she being, prior to my removal to the hermitage, virtually my next-door neighbour. "Oh, you must visit Shantiniketan," she had insisted, as though Shantiniketan was the very mecca, not only of Bengali, but of world culture. My friends Lama Govinda and Lee Gotami had sung the same siren song. They had come to know each other when he was a professor there and she a student, and it seemed I had no alternative but to visit the place sooner or later. Hence, my work with the Mahabodhi Society calling for another visit to Calcutta, I had decided that this time I would spend a few days at Shantiniketan en route. Started by Tagore at the turn of the century as an experimental school with five pupils and five teachers, Shantiniketan had developed into, quote, a centre of Indian culture, a seminary of Eastern studies, and a meeting place for the East and the West, end quote. In brackets, Krishna Kripalani. Though without altogether losing its rural character, and without growing too big for it to be possible for everybody to know everybody else. Visvabharati, or Universal India, as the great Bengali poet had called his miniature world university, including an art school and a music school, a technical institute, and a handicrafts department, as well as a school of sinology, all of which I visited in the course of the next few days, and in all of which I met interesting people, both Indian and non-Indian. The first person I met after my arrival, however, apart from some young Bengali friends of Bill's, was Madame Combaste, the elderly soignée Frenchwoman to whom I had given English lessons in Kalimpong earlier in the year. Other Western women might go around in saris and shalwar kameez, but Madame Combaste stuck firmly to her Parisian fashions and looked, indeed, much more ready for a walk down the Champs-Élysées than for a stroll in rural Bengal. Despite her sartorial intransigence, she was, it seemed, a popular, even an influential figure around the place, perhaps not least because she was in the habit, as I had noticed in Kalimpong, of assuring her Bengali friends that, just as the French were the aristocrats of the West, so the Bengalis were the aristocrats of the East. At any rate, she was influential enough to be able to suggest But before leaving Shantiniketan, I should give a lecture. I should give it at Tina Bhavan, as the School of Sinology was called, which on the penultimate day of my visit, I did. Not surprisingly, I chose for my subject Buddhism and Art. Pratima Devi, being then resident at Uttarayan, the house in which Tagore himself had lived, naturally lost no time in calling on her. The sweet, dignified old lady was delighted to see me in her beloved Shantiniketan, and as usual treating me with great kindness and consideration. Though it was as a poet and novelist that he was known to the world, having been awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature in 1913. Towards the end of his long life, Tagore had produced a series of extraordinary paintings and drawings. Some of these were on display at Uttarayan, and when we had talked for a while, Pratima Devi showed them to me, after which she took me for a stroll round the house's beautiful gardens. I also called on Dr. and Mrs. Liebenthal, who were then staying at Uttarayan, as well as on Professor and Mrs. North, whom I had already met in Kalimpong. Professor North having in fact given a talk at the Hermitage on English literature. There were also visits to Tina Bhavan, where I met Shanti Bhikshu Shastri and his wife, and Professor Tan Yun Shan. The first was a Buddhist, a scholar in Sanskrit and Tibetan, and a former bhikkhu. Not only was he a former bhikkhu, he was married to a former nun. And at the conclusion of our initial meeting, he and Sujata invited me to have lunch with them a couple of days later. Both were very glad to see me and relieved to be able to talk about themselves without restraint. As I well knew, within the reformist Theravadan community to which they technically belonged, he was a caste Hindu convert, she a Newar by birth. The position of a former bhikkhu or a former nun was a difficult one, and if the former bhikkhu and the former nun happened to be married to each other, their position was doubly and trebly difficult. Shanti Bhikshu, who was very much the older of the two, was obviously not yet quite comfortable in his new role. Despite his layman's white shirt and dhoti, his manner was still very much that of the bachelor scholar, even of the scholar monk. Sujata, on the other hand, had adjusted perfectly to the change and was evidently overjoyed to be married. With her bobbed hair, short Western-style frock and heavy makeup, she not only exuded satisfaction, but was led to remark in the course of our discussion that there were others who were thinking of taking the step she and Shanti Bhikshu had taken. From what I knew of some of the younger Newar nuns, I could well believe this to be the case, though I doubted if many of them would be able to find a former bhikkhu as highly qualified as Shanti Bhikshu and in as good a position to support them, therefore, as he was to support her. In India and Nepal, as in Sri Lanka, a former bhikkhu was unlikely to be as well off financially as a bhikkhu. Consequently, few bhikkhus disrobed, even when they no longer had, if they had ever had, a real vocation for the monastic life. Professor Tan Yun Shan wore the traditional black dress of the Chinese scholar, complete with black skull cap. He had been at Tina Bhavan since its earlier days, having in fact been responsible for starting the school, and being even now the moving spirit behind the place. He had started it with the support of General Chiang Kai-shek and his Kuomintang government. With the defeat of Chiang and the nationalist forces by the communists in 1949, and the former's withdrawal to Taiwan, Professor Tang had lost that support, and the nature of Tina Bhavan's position in relation to the government of the People's Republic, the armies of which had recently invaded Buddhist Tibet, was unclear. Indeed, like that of many overseas Chinese, Professor Tan's own position was unclear, not to say ambiguous. it being rumoured that the new regime in Peking wanted to replace Chiang Kai-shek's protege with a nominee of their own. Naturally, nothing was said of all this in the course of our meeting. Professor Tang showed me the Baoban's collection of Chinese books, the centrepiece of which, at least in my eyes, was the Taisho edition of the Chinese Tripitaka, the 100 thick, closely printed red volumes, each of which was said to contain more than 1,600 separate Buddhist texts, both canonical and extra-canonical. The following day I had tea with him, and he showed me his house and garden, which he evidently had tried to make as much like the traditional Chinese scholar's house and garden as Indian conditions permitted. Professor Tan had, it seemed, put down roots in the land of his adoption, and it was not going to be easy for China's new masters to dislodge him. But interesting as I found the scholars of Shantiniketan, including some whose names I have forgotten, I found the artists and poets more interesting still. They were quite a mixed bunch. There was the famous sculptor Ram Khinka, a stocky, grizzled figure in rumpled Western-style shirt and trousers, whom I met at Kala Bhavan, the School of Art, and with whom I talked at some length. Like many educated Bengalis, he was interested in Buddhism, at least the extent that Buddhism was part of Indian culture, and I'd already seen the figure of the meditating Buddha that he had created in the Kala Bhavan grounds. Considerably larger than life, its rough, unfinished surface texture reminded me of some of that of Epstein's later work, especially his portrait busts. Ashok Raha, with whom I also talked at some length, was by vocation a Bengali poet and by profession a teacher of English literature. We talked mainly about Shelley, for whom he expressed great admiration. His admiration did not surprise me. I knew that most Indian aficionados of English poetry favoured the Romantics, Shelley in particular, and that the youthful Tagore himself had been hailed by his fellow Bengalis as the Bengali Shelley. While I certainly did not regard Shelley as the greatest of English poets, as some Indians did, I too admired and loved him, and my conversation with Ashok Raha, bringing back, as it did, memories of my ecstatic adolescent reading and rereading of Adonais, Prometheus Unbound, and Epipsychidion, had the effect of reviving my interest in the poet and making me resolve that as soon as I reached Calcutta, I would buy his poems and read them all again. Meanwhile, Ashok Dar lent me his own copy of the Oxford edition of the Complete Poetical Works, which he recommended as the best available, containing, as it did, Mary Shelley's notes and prefaces. So that late that night, while Sanchim was out with Bill and his young friends, I had the satisfaction of renewing my acquaintance with the poet in the appropriately romantic surroundings of Shantiniketan. Though at Shantiniketan, as elsewhere, Indian aficionados of English poetry tended to favour the Romantics, the Victorians were by no means neglected. Collecting Sanchin from a meeting one afternoon after fulfilling a couple of engagements of my own, I found some of Browning's poems being recited extremely well, with great feeling, without any of the mimetics with which Bengalis seem to think appropriate when reciting, or rather declaiming, poetry in their own language. Whether or not 20th century English poetry was neglected at Shantiniketan, I did not stay long enough to find out. But I did meet a 20th century English, or rather a 20th century American poet, in the course of my visit. This was John Berry, who, not surprisingly, was a friend of Bill's, and whom Bill, in fact, took me to see. The 20th century poet lived in a very un-20th century mud hut, and with him too I had a long talk. He did not show me any of his poetry, but before Bill and I left, he sang for our benefit, to the guitar, two songs that he may have been of his own composition. Besides artists and poets, during the 5 or 6 days Sanchin and I spent in the Abode of Peace, I also met, as though for good measure, a popular novelist,
This was Anada Shankar Ray, a sophisticated figure in a dark Western-style suit, who occupied, as it seemed, some kind of official position, and who was the author of a number of satirical novels in Bengali. He was married, not surprisingly, to a Western woman, an American, who, again not surprisingly, was a translator of Bengali fiction and poetry. The name of Leela Ray was in fact almost as well known as that of her husband, and the pair were the centre, in Shantiniketan at least, of a cosmopolitan literary circle consisting mainly of anglicised Bengalis and European and American expatriates, some of whom had, like themselves, married across the racial and cultural divide. Thus it was only natural that on the eve of my departure, Leela Ray, who knew me as a contributor to the Aryan Path and other magazines, should give a tea party for me, a tea party at which I saw both people I had met already and people whom I had not met. It was on this occasion, I think, that Kshitish Roy, the translator of some of Tagore's poetry, whom I had not met before, invited me to contribute to the Vishva Bharati Quarterly, of which he was the editor. All too soon our visit to Shantiniketan was over, and after a hasty lunch, Sanchin and I were bowling along the road to Bolpur in cycle rickshaws to catch the Calcutta Mail, the very train from which we had descended less than a week earlier. Bill came with us to the station to see us off. Despite my having so many other people to see, the fresh-faced young American and I had managed to spend a fair amount of time together, discussing, among other things, Professor Burt's comments on his thesis, which was now complete. He also took the opportunity of sharing some of his worries with me. One of these related to an incident which had taken place some weeks earlier and caused him considerable distress. Like most Westerners in Shantiniketan, he slept under a mosquito net. One night the mosquitoes were particularly numerous and persistent, and seeing how grievously his young servant, who slept on the floor of the same room, was being tormented by them, he democratically invited the boy to join him under the mosquito net, which the boy very thankfully did. Next morning, a Bengali woman, happening to pass by, saw through the window a slim brown form emerging from beneath the mosquito net and from Bill's bed, with the result that within hours the news that the American student was sleeping with his young servant had spread through the campus. He had not slept with the boy, Bill assured me, almost with tears in his eyes. Not in the sense that anything had actually happened between them, and I had no difficulty in believing him. Nonetheless, it was obvious that Bill had a decided liking for teenage boys and spent a good deal of time in their company, his particular favourite being Alok, a golden-skinned 18-year-old Adonis, who seemed to be as fond of Bill as Bill was attached to him. Bill's greatest fear, now that his thesis was completed and he was due to return to America, was that something might happen to prevent Alok joining him in New York, as they had planned he should, there to finish his education. If that happened, he told me, as we sat side by side in the rickshaw on our way to Bolpur, Sanchin was in another rickshaw with the bulk of our luggage, he did not know what he would do. He was very fond of Alok. Whether he actually confessed to being in love with the young Bengali, I do not remember, but after a long pause, he sighed wearily and said half to himself, "I guess I must be homosexual."
I did not know what to reply, if indeed reply was needed. The truth was that I knew little more about homosexuality than what I had gleaned 10 or 12 years ago from the pages of Havelock Ellis's The Psychology of Sex. And in any case doubted, Pacey Freud, whether a strong emotional attraction to a member of one's own sex necessarily meant that one was sexually oriented in the same direction. Moreover, this was the first time that anyone had told me, in so many words, even that he must be homosexual, and my silence was due as much to embarrassment as ignorance. It was therefore in silence that Bill and I covered the rest of the distance to Bolpur, where we found Ashok Dar waiting at the station, and where, a few minutes later, Sanchin and I said our goodbyes and boarded the train. On the first stage of our 300-mile rail journey, that from Siliguri to Manihari Ghat, I had passed the time talking to a friend of Sanchin's who happened to get into the same compartment. Now, on the last stage of that journey, the time was shortened by a long conversation with a ticket inspector who was interested in Buddhism, so that when, 3.5 hours after our departure from Bolpur, the train clanked its way through the sordid northern suburbs of Calcutta and into Sealdah Station, I was surprised to see that we were already there. The station was not a pretty sight. Encamped along the broad platforms, between the iron pillars, the stacks of wooden crates, and the refreshment kiosks, as well as outside in the station forecourt, were thousands, perhaps tens of thousands, of refugees from the former East Bengal, all living in conditions of the utmost wretchedness and degradation. Some of the earlier arrivals had contrived to build shelters out of gunny bags, flattened kerosene tins and bits of cardboard, and from most of these, of which there must have been hundreds in the forecourt, there fluttered the red flag of communism. Communist Party cadres having done more to relieve the sufferings of the refugees, apparently, than had the Congress state government, and being in fact very active among them. With the help of the young men from the Mahabodhi Society office who had been sent to meet us, we pushed through the throng of passengers, both arriving and departing, hawkers, refugees and beggars, and 10 minutes later were being deposited outside the pink sandstone façade of the Sri Dharmarajika Vihara, and the taxi driver was doing his best to overcharge me, as I usually did on such occasions. I left it to the formidable Durban, or gatekeeper, to settle with him on my behalf, and, followed by a Sanchin, made my way down the side of the Vihara to the 3-story building that was the Society's headquarters. Here we were greeted by Deva Priya Valensina, the General Secretary of the Society, and others who were known to me, both monks and laymen, assigned our quarters, my old room on the second floor, and served us very strong cups of tea in very thick white china. We then went out on foot, out into the hustle and bustle that was Calcutta at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, or indeed at almost any hour of the day or night. After the sightseeing and socialising of Shantiniketan, I would have been content to spend the evening quietly, perhaps with a book. But Sanchin, who had not been to Calcutta before, was eager to see the bright lights of the big city. For him, as for so many young hillmen, Calcutta represented freedom, represented opportunity, represented excitement, represented, in short, life with a capital L. And apart from New York, a distant, impossible dream, there was no place that he, like them, was more desirous of seeing. Moreover, he was anxious to meet his relatives, and since some of them lived in central Calcutta, a part of the city with which I was reasonably familiar, he wanted me to accompany him and help him locate the place. Having drunk our tea, out into the evening air we therefore went, cutting across College Square with its crumbling statues of bygone dignitaries, into College Street, and going along College Street, past the butcher's stalls and the sweetmeat shops, as far as Wellington Square, famous venue of political meetings, where, turning right, we pursued our course down Dharamtala Street to the Esplanade and Chowringhee, all the while taking good care, whenever we were forced off the crowded pavement, to avoid the single-decker double tram cars that every few minutes came clanging and swaying along, all full and all with scores of passengers hanging on outside. From Chowringhee, we did not have very far to go to Hindustan Building, a solidly built, rather gloomy pile situated in the midst of dingy side streets. Sanchin's relatives, who comprised two separate households occupying adjacent flats on the second floor, were delighted to see him and made me, too, very welcome. There were quite a lot of them, especially in the form of aunts and female cousins, besides several small children. In the course of the next few weeks, I accompanied Sanchin to Hindustan buildings a number of times and got to know the occupants of one flat quite well. Some of them, indeed, visited us at the Mahabodhi Society, and one, an unmarried schoolteacher, who was always referred to, even within the family, as Miss Singh, as though she was a schoolteacher even at home, became seriously interested in Buddhism and attended my lectures. During this first visit, however, they naturally were a little shy of me, Hari Didi bringing tea to me in the front room, while Sanchin was being entertained in the ruins behind. On our way back to the Mahabodhi Society, 2 hours later, my companion and I looked into the bookshops in Dharmatala Street, these being still open, as were most shops. Not only were the shops open, the streets were full of people and there was plenty of noise. Even after I'd gone to bed, the roar of traffic, punctuated by the sound of human voices raised in anger or supplication, could still be heard, and it was a long time before I was able to sleep. If Shantiniketan was the abode of peace, I reflected as I lay there, surely Calcutta was the city of dreadful noise. But Calcutta was not only the city of dreadful noise, it was also the city of palaces, most of them now in ruins, and the city of mainly political processions, of which there were said to be more than 300 a year. It was the city of Kali and Sarasvati, of Clive and Siraja Dowla, of William Carey and Warren Hastings, of Thackeray and Macaulay, of Sri Ramakrishna and Swami Vivekananda, of the Tagores and the Mullicks. It was the city of governor-generals and viceroys, of museums and learned societies, of the Victoria Memorial and the Ochterlony Monument, of the Hindu Mahasabha and the Muslim League, of students and workers. For me, of course, Calcutta was the city of Anagarika Dhammapala and the Mahabodhi Society with the Sri Dharmarajika Vihara, and the headquarters building constituting, in my eyes, a tiny island of Buddhism in the midst of the vast ocean of Hinduism, an island in which there are only two or three other islands, each one tinier than the one whereon I was encamped. Literally, and even to an extent, metaphorically, my life in Calcutta centred on the society. Attractive and interesting though the city might be, the society was my base, and it was from this base that I went out, and to which I returned. End of chapter 4.